I have John with me on the phone.
Yes, I'm here.
And tonight our subject is going to be about believing. Okay, I've been, in the past couple of weeks, been looking at, I don't know if, John, if you've ever looked at Rafael Almeida's site.
No, I haven't.
You haven't? He did an interesting thing on where he analyzed the Blue Book, The Bible Tells Me So, and 10 Things to Throw Out. Is something with a baby in the bathwater. I forget how he works. 10 things that work and 10 things that don't. He spent quite a bit of time on the thing about believing. And I think it's become a very, the more and more I read about it and read different things in the forum, believing was a very important aspect outside of the Holy Spirit field. It was a very important aspect of what we walked away with from the way. And it's one of those things, just like Jesus Christ is not God, that we still cling to, even though we might not know exactly what it is. I was wondering if you'd like to say a few words about believing. We could probably set up the different types of believing, and I think that, at least I always found that Dr. Werwell did more, was leaning more toward the motivational things as far as believing goes, rather than what it actually was.
How do you mean motivational? Just motivate people to believe?
Or? I walked away with the feeling that it became more of, you know, like the Dale Carnegies, the Zig Ziglars, where what they really were talking about was confidence, but calling it believing. I mean, it is a form of believing, but really psyching you up so that you can go out and do these things when, you know, like... Go ahead. A lot of times, you know, you'd hear a motivational speech by somebody, and in 20 or 30 minutes, they've basically wrapped up their whole life, and you get this impression that it's some kind of a magical power, when actually it's a lot of hard work. And
well, I'm sure it was used motivationally, and, you know, that was probably an important aspect of his work, is trying to motivate people or excite them. But I think theologically it's important to several doctrines. I mean, it's critical to their idea of healing, which was a key feature. It's critical to their idea of tithing, of prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea of believing underlies several practices. Even operating the manifestations kind of is based on believing that this is available and then doing it because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see how he'd use it motivationally, but I think that that's also the basis to several other doctrines that were also important to them.
Right.
But why do you think this is such a critical thing that people take with them when they leave the way? Why does it grip people the way one or two other doctrines do, but others don't?
I think it's something that people like to believe. It's got a, for me, it almost... With things that I've read, it almost becomes a magical thing rather than something that is logical or, but not a. I don't look at it. You know, the whole, what believing equals receiving, isn't necessarily true, because you can believe in some. I can believe to fly, but I'm not going to fly. And some of it almost goes over into a. A, like I said, a magical thing, and, you know, I suppose you could even say it lends itself almost to witchcraft in what the outcome that you're expecting. It's almost as if you're telling God what to do rather than having faith. The believing almost, it works the opposite, like you're trying to force God to do something for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that is attractive. One feature of the New Age movement and of occultism in general is that you have this power, this hidden power available to you. You know, whether that's, you sharpening your razor blades under a pyramid, you know, the kind of power,
mm-hmm.
whether it's determining the future by tarot cards or a pendulum or a Ouija board or something.
Right.
There is this attraction to power that we have. And, you know, it does excite people. And, you know, don't we all want power, you know, something more than the average life that we all have of, you know, putting in your time and doing your work and doing your duties and to have that sense of power that's beyond what everybody else has is really exciting and attractive. So I guess if you give that up when you leave the group, then you're also giving up that hope, that excitement, that belief that you can control your life and future and make it better than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of times it was like it became a synonym for when people were actually saying maybe hope or expectations. You know, like, I believe Johnny's going to be here at that Twig tonight, you know. And mm-hmm. when it's actually that you're expecting him or you're just hoping that he'll be there.
Well, a lot of the groups that believe in believing take that a step farther, you know, and they would say, and you've probably heard this before as well, that hoping in something is declaring doubt. So you can't say hope.
Right.
Or wishing or wanting even is just declaring some kind of doubt. So you probably become almost obsessed with using the right term.
Right.
And, you know, at times it becomes kind of comical how people express hope or expectation or desire without actually saying that. So I guess believing is a handy little label they can use to substitute for that. But there's other forms of, you know, believing that are outside, you know, groups that have a more biblical framework. Christian Science has a form of believing, you know, they call them affirmations, basically equivalent to positive confession. And that's a completely godless system, and they certainly don't have a personal God. And many forms of the occult are basically the same, where it's the power of the mind that does that. And, you know, this was the basis of the New Thought movement, you know, started like 1900s or so and spawned Christian Science and several other groups, is that, you know, you can control your world, your life, by the power of your mind. And that's what believing amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God is maybe somewhere behind the scenes, but still basically amounts to, you know, this is available, now you execute it by your believing.
Right.
You take control of your life. You cause your healing, you prevent your illness, you cause your prosperity, you prevent your loss of a job, whatever, by believing.
But now, let me ask you this. You were talking about the Christian Scientists with the affirmations. What about when you give yourself a pep talk, so to speak, where you want to enforce positive things versus negative things? That's not necessarily ungodly in and of itself.
No, I mean, that's basically positive thinking.
Right.
And, you know, certainly if you go into any situation with a good deal of self-doubt, you know, you're less likely to do well at that or to even assert what, you know, natural abilities or knowledge that you have. So that is almost more akin to confidence than anything else.
Right, right.
And, you know, that's certainly a productive use of that. And that's something that, you know, a non-Christian, I guess, would relate to and a Christian could learn something from.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of them might take that secular idea and then kind of coat it with some kind of Christian veneer and sell it as being a Christian concept rather than just a, you know, secular positive thinking kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of different forms of this believing idea. You know, they really run the gambit. Things that are pretty innocent and innocuous, even, you know, somewhat biblical, to just the other extreme, which is, you know, they, in their viewpoint of believing, leave behind basic Christian doctrines and ideas so that really what a person is practicing is something that's quite different from Scripture.
Now, what about faith as opposed to believing?
Well, there's no difference at all from a biblical standpoint. There's one word for believing or faith, mm-hmm. you know, that's used. It's basically a fluke of English that when we use a noun, we use faith, and very seldom use the word belief. It is just common use. But when you use a verb, you don't say, well, I'm faithing something,
right?
You know,
right.
Or I faith in something. You know, we don't use faith as a verb. We just use it as a noun. So we use believe as a verb. So that's just a fluke of English. So I think that's another example where Victor Werwell and the Way basically imposed a distinction in English that doesn't exist in Greek, and made faith and believing two completely different things. But as you see it translated in the New Testament, sometimes where it uses the word faith, a noun, it's actually translating the verb, you know, participle, believing, that they translated as a noun, because that's basically how it's used in the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably can't tell real well just looking at the English if there's a noun or a verb form. But either way, you know, it stems from the same Greek word behind it. So his distinction between faith and believing is, you know, completely ignorant so far as the Bible use of the terms or words still.
When we were in the way, we got, I guess arrogance probably the word, where our prayer wasn't so much a request as it was a demand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like your thoughts on that. That, because I know that when I hear prayers in churches post-way, they're very much different than the types of prayers we would hear at a Twig or branch meeting or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And almost to, you know, I guess the best word I can think of is just arrogant. You know, where, you know, what do we have the right to be like that in front of God and Jesus Christ?
You know, I sense some of the same thing. And, you know, I think there's a real strong distinction there. Prayer, as you hear it in a lot of churches, really emphasizes relationship. That God is my creator. I'm, you know, the creature, a human being. You know, he made me. I submit my will to his, and I relate to him. So he uses terms like, you know, shepherd and sheep, you know, father and child, mm-hmm. to indicate this relationship that we have. And that's where really the basic nature of prayer is that, you know, it's a child talking to a father. And, you know, Jesus uses that image several times when he talks about prayer. When you look at the Way's approach to prayer, I think it leaves out the relationship to a great degree.
Mm-hmm.
It sees God as someone who has provided a means for you to get what you want, within reason, but basically provided the means, which is believing. And it's up to you to accomplish this on your own. So the picture, the relationship is taken out of the picture.
Right.
You're not one person going to another, your Lord, and requesting something. Rather, you're someone who's using this weapon that God has given you to get it for yourself. So instead of you ask, God delivers, it's yourself who is delivering or accomplishing it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, I'm sure, what you sensed when you think about, you know, prayers and the Way being like demands, because that's their nature. It's not based on a relationship. It's not based on requesting. It's not even based on being submissive to God. But it's based on accomplishing what you want. So there's a different center. You know, prayer, the biblical view of prayer is pretty much God-centered. You know, I have my need or my desire, whatever that is. And God is the one I go to. So he's the center of the prayer experience. But in the Way, it's very man-centered, and believing is the main part of that, where, you know, it's actually your will that you're executing. You know, God's maybe made these things available to you, but you're deciding what you want. You're deciding if it, you know, lines up with what you desire or what you think is in the Word. You're deciding it, and you're making a means to get it through believing.
Right.
So it's very man-centered, not God-centered. And it's very law-centered in the sense that God's told you to do this, in a sense. You're following this law and then doing it on your own. That's quite different from grace or a gift that God gives you. In fact, it really makes God to be a stingy one. Well, you get it on your own, is what he's saying. Don't expect anything from me. Now, you know, you'll get according to your believing. So if you believe for something big, you get something big. If you believe something little, you get something little. if you fear, you'll get penalized or punished, you know, because it's destructive. So God's really sitting on the sideline. He's not involved at all. There's no grace involved in this. In fact, even if you look at the terminology used in the way, it's the law of believing, right?
Right, exactly.
So the law is not a gift. It's not a relationship. You know, it's just a requirement that you are told, instructed, you know, required to carry out. You know, so where is grace in this? Where is even God in this? You know, he's not certainly not active at all. It's like God isn't a father in this relationship. He's like he's a weapons dealer because he basically gives you this tool, this law. Okay, so if you use this weapon for good, you know, you're more like a cop, right? You're using your weapon to subdue the bad guys. But if you use your weapon for bad, then you're destroying something or someone or yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have doubt, then you're causing illness to come to yourself. I think the most disgusting thing that I recall from Power for Abundant Living is when VP Werewolf says, oh, yeah, there's this mother who's really concerned for her child. You know, she's worried that he's going to get run over in the street. And lo and behold, this child is killed in the street.
Right.
And in his book, he actually says, you know, so do you know who killed that little boy? The fear of the mother did. She reaped the results of her believing. So it's like this mother, through her fear, killed her own child. And it's a horrible thing to say.
Right.
So God is not only not involved in this, you know, he's given mankind this destructive force and caused these terrible things to happen. So really, you know, in the ways you, when you come right down to it, God doesn't treat us when it comes to the law of believing like a father. He treats us like a weapons dealer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a horrible thought. And you just said it so blatantly. It's really sad. And that people, it's even sadder that people would become so guilty as a result.
Right.
Because if you do get sick, whose fault is it? It's yours.
Right.
You know, and what if you are fearful of your child getting sick and your child gets sick? Well, then you feel guilty because you made your own child sick, you know, by your fear. And what if, you know, there's an economic downturn and you're afraid of getting laid off, and then you do get laid off? Well, who's at fault for this? You know, it's not the company. You're at fault. You caused your own loss of your job. So it engenders a lot of guilt in people.
Right.
Unless they really screen out what's there in the way theology, you know, that's where you come down. There's a real strong guilt trip, and more fear is what it engenders in people because the stakes are so high. You know, so if you're going to doubt you're going to get healed, if you're going to fear that you're going to get sick, the stakes are really high, and then that probably makes you more fearful because you're such aware that you can cause havoc in your life just from little passive doubts.
Right. Right. Yeah, it makes it almost like a competition than what it is. You know, someone's got more believing than you and things like that. Yeah, I remember when that thing about the mother and the child just creeped me out the first time mm-hmm. I heard it, and every time after that too.
The way's form of believing, you know, is really one of the worst forms out there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are certainly other faith teachers, as they call them. You know, for years there's been Kenny Copeland and Kenny Hagin and, you know, Fred Price and a lot of teachers that are on Christian, you know, television
right.
that teach some form of believing. But, you know, when you look at Werewolf's form of it, it's got most of the worst features of them. And, you know, the kind of guilt it produces, the kind of law it puts on people and, the, you know, centered on human beings is a big chunk of that. And it's basically a godless system. You know, when Werewolf talks about believing, he says, well, it works for saint, sinner alike. Doesn't matter if you're Christian or non-Christian.
Right.
So that's an atheistic system. God is not involved. And, you know, good things come to evil people who are non-Christian. Bad things, because they believe in his view. I know bad things come to good Christians who have good character and love because they doubt. You know, God is really out of the picture. It's an atheistic system. That's true of whatever he calls a law, whether it's law of tithing, law of prosperity, law of believing. Basically, God is not involved. And whenever you separate God from the Christian life, or in this case, when you separate God from delivering a blessing, you know, from any kind of blessing, then who gets the credit for it? You know, you do,
right?
Because you believe. Not God doesn't. He gets no praise out of this at all. God isn't involved at all. He might as well be an atheist. In fact, according to him, atheists can work this law of believing more effectively than anything else.
Yep.
So if you're promoting, as a ostensibly Christian teacher, if you're promoting an idea that is at its core atheistic, you know, is this a God-pleasing thing to teach? And is it a God-pleasing thing to teach using the Bible to teach this? You know, certainly not. But God is very much out of the picture.
Right.
And the result of that is, if you accomplish something, then you're proud. And that's where the aspect of competition comes up that you mentioned before.
Right.
You know, if you are making more money, does that mean you're believing better than the guy next to you? Well, you can certainly be proud and think you are. But conversely, what if it doesn't work? You know, what if you do lose your job or you don't get a raise? Well, then instead of pride, then you move to despair. And there's no way out of this because it's a law, you know, just like gravity, and it's up to you to do it or not. So where is God in this? Is he the savior? Is he the rescuer? Well, he can't, you know, because he's already set up this law, so you're on your own. But certainly the core of all of the Bible, and especially the New Testament, is that God comes to us as Savior. He doesn't just put this law on us and step out of the picture and say, hey, you sink or swim. It's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's certainly God's nature, because there's no grace in that. And, you know, John says, you know, God is love, and certainly the grace of God is, you know, something that's repeated again and again in the New Testament. But there's no grace at all when you distill things down to laws, law of believing, or law of prosperity, or whatever that would be.
Now, what about the, I think it was Oldies Man had asked the question about the verses in the verse in Mark about the, if you say to this mountain, move, and if you have faith, it'll move.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come in perspective?
Well, if you look at it in its context, okay, the basic question is this verse saying that the degree of your believing is what makes this work? If you believe enough, it'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't believe enough, it won't happen. Or if you doubt, what'll happen then to the mountain? I don't know, something worse. Does it blow up? I don't know. Or is it speaking of a relationship with God that is based on prayer, submitting your requests to God? Which is it? Now, if you look at the context, before it says, you say to the mountain, be, you know, taken up and cast into the sea. But what's the line right before it? It says, have faith in God. So that establishes the relationship already. You're not having faith in the mountain moving. You're having faith in God moving the mountain, which is a completely different thing. The verse after it is also a prayer kind of verse. You know, Jesus says, you know, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you've received it. Well, he's using the word ask, not, he doesn't say whatever you believe will happen, that will happen. He says whatever you ask in prayer, believing. So it still establishes that relationship with God in which you come with some humility and submission rather than just direct you to accomplishing this on your own. And the verse after it, you know, establishes the same thing. You know, when you're praying, if you forgive, and our Father in heaven will forgive you. You know, it's bookended with those relationship kind of verses. Have faith in God, and the Father will forgive you when you pray. So that's the context you take that in.
Right.
You know, what faith teachers tend to do is they take that one verse out of the middle and basically say, okay, this means if you believe hard enough, the mountain will move. But don't believe hard enough, it won't. It takes God out of the picture again, which was missing the whole point. Now, in the way, you know, they took that phrase, have faith in God, and made it into a thing, have faith of God, you know, some kind of faith. You know, by interpreting that way, they took God out of the picture. basically, that was their point. Mm-hmm. To take God out of the picture and make it a law that's basically an atheistic kind of a law. You know, that doesn't make sense at all. You know, it's very much a faith in God. There's kind of a sliding scale here. And I think the more you take God out of the picture, the more distant you get from the Christian faith. So what we're looking for is to have faith in Christ, not having faith in it, whatever it is. And what counts is who you believe, not how much you believe. That's the whole point. You know, there's another verse that I think is often misused by people, and that's the section where Jesus is in Nazareth, and he teaches in the synagogue, and, you know, it closes out by saying Jesus couldn't do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. Yeah, now, what the faith teachers do is they look at this and say, it's because the people didn't believe that they could be healed. They didn't have enough believing to believe for their healing. But if you look at the context of that, where is the unbelief? The people say, hear Jesus teach, and they see the miracles, and they say, how could it come from this man? He's the carpenter's son. We know him. He was raised here. We know his mom and his sisters. See, the unbelief was that they didn't believe that he was the son of God, that he was the son of David, that he was the Messiah. That was the missing belief. And that's the reason why, you know, they didn't even ask him for healing, because they thought he was just a carpenter.
Right.
So the unbelief is unbelief in Christ. It's not unbelief in being able to be healed. And that's the real junction point throughout the New Testament, is it's your relationship with Christ that's at issue. It's belief in him that's at issue, not belief in some law being accomplished or being able to accomplish something through your belief. The other striking thing that I see is, you know, many faith teachers try to, you know, if you believe, the big problem with believing is what happens when it doesn't happen? And everybody runs into this sooner or later. You know, you believe to be healed, but you still have a cold for another week, or, you know, whatever the problem is. So the real issue comes in, what do you do when that happens? Now, Werewolf's answer, and we talked about that before, was to blame the woman, the victim. To blame the victim for not believing hard enough. This is not something you find Jesus doing. Sometimes he criticizes the 12 apostles for not being able to heal someone. But he doesn't criticize the victim for not believing hard enough. So there's the instance where, you know, the man brings his child, his son, who is possessed by a demon, and he throws himself into the fire. He brings him to the apostles to be healed. They can't do it, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus steps up. He asks him if he has faith to do this. And there's two important things that happen. One is, one happens, one doesn't. The thing that doesn't happen is Jesus does not chide either the son or the father for not believing hard enough. He doesn't say, well, the reason that the apostles could not heal you is because you didn't believe hard enough. He doesn't say that. He does talk to the apostles, who should know better by now, and say, well, you're ministers of God. It's your small faith. But he doesn't chide the victim or the victim's father for being too short on faith. The second thing that happens, which is a verse that I hold on to all the time, is the father says to Jesus, he says, I believe, help my unbelief. Now, he's admitting unbelief. So shouldn't Jesus say, well, torque it up. This is the law of believing. Believe harder, and you'll be able to do this. You're the problem. You're limiting what God is able to do for you, but he doesn't. It's like he accepts that, but in this man, there's a mixture. There's belief, and there's unbelief. And Christ recognizes enough belief to heal them. How does he see the belief? Well, the guy comes to Jesus asking. So in every one of the gospel accounts of a miracle, the person came to Jesus. Okay? the problem, they weren't sitting at home and, you know, being short on believing, so they weren't healed, or trying to be harder, more unbelieving, so they could be healed. They went to Jesus, and that's the statement of faith, is going to Jesus. And I think, you know, this is what human life is like. We're all a mixture of believing and unbelieving, you know, faith and non-faith. And the wonderful thing is, you know, the message of grace is that God welcomes us even though we're short on faith, even we're short on believing. You know, even because we're short on holiness, we're short on everything. But the point of the gospel is God's grace doesn't say, well, step it up and believe harder. You know, step it up and be more holy. God's grace says, I'll make you holy. I'll give you the gifts that you can't afford on your own and can't earn on your own. And this is the grace of God that comes out. And so the guy's healed. Well, why should he be? He didn't have enough believing. He admitted unbelief. He shouldn't be healed by the standpoint of the law of believing law. But Jesus does deliver because it's the grace of God, which is the basis of the miracle. In fact, there's like, you know, a couple dozen miracles in the book of Luke, and only like three or four times does Jesus mention anything about the person's faith. You know, it's enough for him that they're coming to him, and then he gives them grace. Well, you know, one other component of this, or one result of this law of believing, is, and perhaps you've seen this too, is what happens when somebody does get sick? What is the response of the people around the sick person? If they see this person as being short on believing, what do? Well, you tell them, hey, it's your fault. You know, believe harder. You know, it's a demand you're putting on the person, or right. Exhortation. It's not kindness.
Right.
Or, you know, if they're really guilty, you might condemn them. You wonder, perhaps, you know, if this is a doubtful person, will I become more doubtful by being around them?
Mm-hmm.
So what tends to happen is the compassion fades because you're just demanding, you know, and they're thinking they're following God's pattern in this, demanding that they follow the law of believing, that they believe harder, rather than showing compassion or grace. The person tends to be more isolated, and the people around them that believe this tend to be colder, basically. But, you know, inside your heart, if you love someone, it's hard to be cold like that. I mean,
right.
You want to show compassion. So I think the person on the outside has this struggle going on inside. Well, I want to show compassion, you know, but is this person who's falling short, they're guilty. How can I show compassion to someone who's doing something wrong, who's been guilty? So I think they're torn, and because of that, the compassion factor is reduced.
Yeah.
And so you have less of a feeling of love and support that you need, because you aren't really getting support. You're getting teaching, maybe, and exhortation, but you're not getting as much support. And so a person is more isolated, you know, more on their own.
Right. Yeah, that happened all too often, too.
You know, it's the other thing is I think about this teaching, and, you know, Werbel didn't start this, obviously. Most of the faith teachers in America stem back to following E.W. Kenyon. And Werbel, in fact, plagiarized some of Kenyon's books, but he also took a whole lot of his teaching, you know, pretty much lock, stock, and barrel. And the law of believing was one of those things.
Oh, really?
Kenyon basically presented it like Werbel did, which is, you know, there's positive believing and negative believing. You cause bad results in your life by doubt or fear, or you create good results by your positive believing,
mm-hmm.
by your lack of doubt.
Right.
But one thing that strikes me is how many of these faith teachers died young. There was one guy, I guess in the 20s or 30s, called Allen. He died of alcoholism. You know, like 50 years old or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Werbel himself, I mean, he dies of cancer, first eye cancer and then liver cancer.
Right.
He dies of cancer age 67. I mean, this is, 10 years young, so far as actuaries say.
Right.
He died young.
Yeah.
One of the famous examples is Hobart Freeman, who led the faith assembly in the late 70s and early 80s. And he was very strongly a faith teacher where, you know, you believe hard enough, you accomplish this, you doubt and you will be penalized, you know, in some way. But he had polio his whole life and a withered leg, a short leg because of that. He never grew out. Well, why shouldn't it if he's a faith teacher?
Right.
Then he died at age 64, you know, of heart failure and bronchial pneumonia, you know, things that were treatable. And in his faith assembly, which emphasized this faith message and was a linchpin in that time period, they figured that there were about 8 deaths a year in that one church because people didn't seek medical treatment.
Right.
Because in their view, the law of believing said, if you seek medical treatment, you're admitting you have the disease, you're doubting. And if you refuse medical treatment, it shows that you're really depending on God alone, not your senses. Well, 8 deaths a year from this, you know, alleged powerhouse of believing. So here these guys die young, you know, Freeman, Werwell, Allen, you know, die young. Well, if these are the teachers, the master believers, what are they doing not even making an average?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I can't read God's mind, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if God let these people die young just to send a message to their followers to say, these guys are dead wrong when it comes to believing. They couldn't do it themselves, and then here they load it on you. Reminds me of the line from Peter saying about the law that, you know, neither us nor our fathers were able to bear this. You know, well, he recognized that, but somehow many of the followers of Werwell and Freeman and others, you know, see how it doesn't work right in front of their eyes. You know, the master believer can't do it, and yet it doesn't quite register to them that this is an indication that the teaching is wrong.
That's interesting. We have a lot of unlearning to do. It's, you know, it goes along. I think we spoke of this in another conversation about how people grasp onto some of these things and hold fast to them, even though they know that there's all sorts of other things that are wrong, but for some reason, certain things, as the law of believing, people still hang on to that so much. And it's very sad. I know there was a gentleman that on a thread was talking about trying to find a church, and, you know, he goes, the only thing that I'm looking for is to make sure that it's a church that believes that the dead aren't alive now and believes that Jesus Christ is not God. And, you know, I left a comment. I said, what if those two things were things that may not be true? You're searching for something that might not be what's correct in God's plan. And got an interesting responses because, you know, I don't think people think about that much. They kind of assume that this stuff was right, and it gets reinforced by incidents, which aren't really part of going to God meekly.
And I think one thing that makes it worse is, for some people, they have a bias against actually studying it seriously. So how can they even evaluate what they learned in the way or correct it if they aren't even willing to seriously face that?
Right, right.
And with the topics you're talking about, you know, most all of them, you know, whether it's the nature of Jesus or believing or, you know, dead alive now kind of idea. I mean, there are some serious Christian books where they really, in detail, you know, study these teachings and also, in some cases, you know, study or answer the claims of Werwell or, you know, others who have those views. So there is ways to do serious study about this if you want to do that. But if you start out with the assumption that you're not even going to evaluate that, well, you know, how can you make any gains, you know, even if they're perfectly biblical ones to be made?
Okay. I think we got a couple of questions here. We're going to talk to Suda, who is Sudo's wife. Her name is Carol. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I think a lot of people did recognize the era, And that's what led to a lot of the, you know, the quashing of, you know, they would go and say, I prayed, you know, obviously this isn't God's will because it's not coming through. And they're saying, no, it is God's will. And it's your fault. And I think there were a lot of people who in their hearts knew that the law was an error because the law is absolute. And so that's how they would say, well, I know that this is God's will for you. And people would be going, but I know it's not. But they were sometimes bullied into thinking, okay, then it must be my error. So I think the people who did see that there was error there, they were bullied into, you know, changing their mind, if that makes any sense. Just like the mountaintop checkbook, you go and you make this demand deposit. I demand it, therefore it's going to come. And that does work when you are claiming a promise from God. That doesn't work when you're claiming something that is not a promise. Like red drapes are not a promise. Am I making any sense?
Can you hear her, John?
Most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They saw themselves as God already had the will. God's will was already that you should be healed of everything, every time, immediately. And God's will is people should be prosperous every time, immediately, all the time.
And I think the thankfulness, when you give a prayer of thanksgiving, that was changed from thanksgiving, thanking God for the blessings that you have received, to thank you, God, for giving me this I'm asking for.
Well, that's
so
true.
So they misapplied thanksgiving.
Yeah, and some of them talk about that. You thank God in advance. You don't ask for anything because you already have this available.
Right.
Thank Him in advance as a, and that's part of your positive confession or part of your statement of believing by which you accomplish it, even though it isn't true.
They took out the supplication and changed it.
And either way, that takes the relationship out of prayer, because it does become demands rather than prayers or requests. You know, the person who's in charge of your life or what you get, you know, is no longer God, it's you. And you're determining this and controlling it by what you believe or don't believe.
Because for many, that crumbled their relationship that they were building. This whole law of believing just separated them totally. Because it was confusing, they couldn't understand it. And, you know, it was the first step in, you know, that destruction of their personal relationship with God.
Also, we got ex-cathedra wants to talk. She's been chomping at the bit here. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Hello, Judas Priest. Can you yell? I can't hear a thing you're saying. So when you talk to me, just scream.
I'll work on that.
All right. How old are you?
Want me to play my guitar too?
Huh? How old are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
Really? Is that what she said?
Yeah.
That's what she says.
Are you not allowed to say?
I'm almost as old as Pawtucket is.
Yeah, and that's old.
You're like in the PFL class, or how I was taught in the way, is like, I am believing my so-and-so won't die of cancer. You know, I'm believing. What do you think about that? Are you there?
I'm sure they are believing that they won't die of cancer. You know, I guess the way most Christians say it is, I'm praying he won't die of cancer. I'm hoping, you know, I'm encouraging that person to do that. So that would be another way of saying that. You know, it's certainly nothing wrong with saying that I'm believing for a healing. I mean, God, one positive thing of the teaching about believing and the law of believing is it really does exhort us to not just to, you know, accept what we can see or what human beings can do, but rather that we do believe that God will intervene and that he will answer our prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly so many times the New Testament does say that, you know, real bluntly, you know, don't be afraid, believe. And that is a good exhortation, because the opposite of any kind of believing is just, you know, what you see is all you get. And as human beings, you know, we don't always see good stuff. I mean, we do see illness, we see needs unmet and so forth. And so the positive side of that is we do need to believe, to trust God for those things and trust that he does intervene and that he is Savior. So that's a very positive part of the faith teaching.
Great. Well, we have a couple more people that want to ask questions here. This is Rainbow's Girl. She's fairly recent. You just came. How long have you been at Greasepot now?
Since January. I'm sorry, I've had laryngitis for the last 2 weeks. I hope you can hear me.
I can hear you. John Key.
So far.
Yep.
Okay. What I was thinking about was, you know, I agree with what you're talking about with believing, how the believing, you know, it seemed like we were required to do what God was, what we had wanted God to do. But at the same time, we were also taught to let go and let God, which was a major confusion to me, because they seemed that they were at cross purposes. Because if we actually, the times that I did believe for things, you know, where I let go and let God, it did usually come to pass. And then I was also wondering what you thought about speaking in tongues being perfect prayer to God.
Speaking in tongues being what?
Perfect prayer
perfect
to God.
Prayer to God.
I wouldn't say that one kind of prayer is perfect prayer and all other kinds are not. You know,
okay.
The book of Corinthians definitely says that, you know, in speaking in tongues, we do speak to God, and we're edified through that. So in that way, it's a very good kind of prayer. But to say it's the perfect kind of prayer is almost to say that anything other kind of prayer is less than that, or imperfect, or almost unacceptable. And I wouldn't say that's the case at all. Paul's conclusion is, he's going to pray with his mind and with his spirit. And I think both of those are important. In praying in tongues, you really don't know what you're praying for unless there's some interpretation. And even then, you know, I don't know that you know the whole picture. So the Bible does talk about different kinds of prayers, you know, prayers, supplications, thanksgivings. You probably find 4 or 5 varieties of prayer mentioned in the New Testament. And I'd say each of them is very good and, you know, perfect in its own sense, you might think.
Okay, well, thank you.
And I wouldn't want to do without any of those.
Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome. Hope your voice gets better. It's better than it was last week, though.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Can I add something to this?
Oh, yeah.
What someone mentioned a moment ago, you know, they demanded things in believing because they believed that there were the promises of God that they were appropriating there. And there's a good deal of truth to that. I mean, God does give us promises in the New Testament with a purpose, which is that we do see that, you know, God will give us these things that we need and that we will trust him for these. there's a couple things that are probably added into that picture that sometimes people overlook when they talk about believing. One is that they seem to assume that any promise was always for every situation and right now, and that you should believe and you'll get whatever you want, you know, right now. And I don't think that's the case with every promise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Abraham was promised the land, and yet the Bible says he was a visitor of, someone passing through. He wasn't a resident. The only thing he owned was the gravesite. So he himself did not own the land that was promised to him, although his, you know, some of his descendants did, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one problem with this idea is it takes something good, namely the promises of God, but it goes to the extreme of saying, always, in every case, right now, and when I believe, it'll happen. And I think that's taking it to an extreme. You know, if you look so far as sickness goes, you know, when people talk about illness, you know, they might select a verse or two of the Bible that seems to contradict that and answer that. But there's a number of times, you know, Galatians talks about Paul when he was sick in Galatia, and that made him stop. You know, Timothy had a stomach ailment. You know, Epaphroditus was near death. Trophimus was still ill as Paul wrote. And yet Paul never says, you know, these guys were just short on faith. They just didn't believe hard enough. Or these are bad examples to follow because these men are not believing. You know, as far as we know, all those men were godly men. And yet, for some reason, there was an ailment that persisted. So this tells me that, you know, yeah, there are the promises of God, but I'm taking it too far to say, you know, always in every case, you know, and right now, and when I believe, that there is an element of God's will and God's timing in there, whether we want to admit that or not. And we're smarter to admit that there's the will of God involved in it than to insist that if you believe hard enough, it'll happen, and if it's not, it's your fault. You know, James says, tells people not to boast about the future, says, you know, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we'll do this or do that, you know. You know, there is an element of God's will, and we don't always know what that is. Now, it's hard for us to submit to that and say, well, yeah, I don't always know God's will, and my will is not always the same as His. It's an aspect of humility that we don't always want to do. You see this element of God's will, like in the, you know, the three men in the fiery furnace in the book of Daniel. You know, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. You know, they go in and they say, "The God we serve is able to save us from this." But even if He does not, you know, we won't serve your gods anyway. Now, they could have said, we're going to believe that we're not going to be injured. But they didn't, you know, and they were held up as God's example. God's will to save us? Great. And if not, you know, we'll die as martyrs. And I think that's ultimately what God calls for us, is that kind of humility and trust, because both of them are in that story. There's humility that says, I'll submit to God's will no matter what it is. But there's also trust that says, God will take care of me. And if it's by saving me from this death, that's great. And if it's by going to be with Him, that's okay too. And that's the kind of faith that you see complemented in Hebrews 11. You know, it gives this long list of the saints, you know, Abraham, you know, Jacob, Gideon, etc. But the point of that is not to say these men believed hard enough and they accomplished it. The point is to say these men trusted in God and God accomplished things that were miraculous at times, and in other times they weren't. You know, the Hebrews 11 also mentions those who were, you know, torn in pieces, sawn apart, you know, died in faith. So whether they, you know, saw a miracle or whether they, you know, died a horrible death, in either case, their devotion, their obedience to God was the sign of the faith, not that they believed to accomplish something. And that's what did it. It's the faith or the believing is focused on the Lord, not focused on the thing. And that's where the law of believing misses the point. It's faith in the thing rather than faith in the Lord. And, you know, the more distant you get from the Lord, the more you're carrying your own load, and, you know, the more you're drifting away from the biblical faith.
Right. Okay, well, let's take one more question. We're almost out of time here. Carol, you had a question?
Yes. One of my favorite verses that deals with prayer is that you call things that they be not as though they were. And I think the application again of that was messed up in the way. But when God puts something on your heart, sometimes it's hard to see how you're going to get there, just like with Abraham and having a baby when they were so old. And so when God puts something on your heart, you do have to visualize that and claim it and go forward with it. But I think too many times in the way the window dressing was, you know, again, leaving God out of the equation, not what he's put on your heart, but what your need is. And therefore, in the whole blue book with the visualization and the describing it and all that, it, again, took him out of the picture. Whereas I think the verses are always talking about what God has put on your heart, or if you're in a situation of trouble and despair, seeing the deliverance that is available and seeing that deliverance in your mind, not necessarily the ABCD of how you get there.
Yeah, you're hoping for the end result rather than the means.
Right.
And, you know, very often God does things through a means that we don't expect. And sometimes we miss an answer to prayer because we're looking for the wrong thing.
Right.
You know, and to mention Sarah, you know, she thought the answer to prayer is that her maid would have a child, namely Ishmael. And that just caused more problems than it solved. So the way that she thought the answer to prayer would come was the wrong one. And, you know, fortunately, she didn't miss, you know, God's grace. She certainly didn't believe to be pregnant. And yet, you know, God granted that gift or that miracle. So I think she's a good example of someone who didn't believe to see it happen, but still saw the blessing anyway.
Right. Or she went through seeing that her, you know, having the handmaiden go in, that was her heart. That was, well, I mean, that's what she had figured out to do. And then she realized that that wasn't it, and God still came through.
Right.
I was thinking about Abraham and Sodom not long ago. You know, Abraham says, you know, Lord, well, don't destroy Sodom, for even if there is 10 righteous people there, right? So Abraham's prayer was that Sodom doesn't get destroyed, which means his nephew doesn't get destroyed. Now, God didn't answer his prayer. I mean, Sodom was destroyed. But he did answer his prayer, because the righteous people in it, namely Lot and his children, were saved. So the answer that Abraham envisioned did not happen. And yet God answered the part of the prayer that was the critical part, which means don't destroy the righteous with the guilty. So you could look at Abraham and say his prayer wasn't answered. Or you can look at it and say, you know, the core of his prayer, the most important part, was answered, but in a different way than he imagined. And I think that sometimes happens with us, too, that our prayer answered in a different way, or part of our prayer is answered in a way we don't expect, but it's still the critical part that's answered. But the person who approaches it from a standpoint of believing figures what he envisions through his believing is God's will. Well, I'd say no, you know, it's not God's will just because you envision it as God's will.
And that's a tough one for the human mind, because you want to be right.
We want to be right.
Yeah.
We'd rather be right than humble.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, we're out of time here. Thank you, John, very much. I appreciate your time. It's always a blessing to have you around. So.
Well, thank you for the compliment there, and I always enjoy talking with you and now with some of your visitors to your website as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, and I'll be talking to you soon. I'd like to get, you were mentioning some books that might be helpful in this arena, and I'd certainly be interested in getting them and making them available to somebody else.
Sure.
Yeah.
One that was helpful to me was called The Health and Wealth Gospel by Bruce Barron. And he goes into a good deal of detail on that and has a lot of good insight.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's still in print or not, I don't know. But. And there's certainly ones on other topics as well.
Right. Okay. Well, again, thanks. And I'll be in touch with you soon.
Welcome. Sounds good.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.